Session number 13265, reel number 28.
Mr. Marsden, reel 28.
Ah, we got back to the aircraft, and we were pestering, you know, when are we going to get off? What time? It's 2 o'clock already. What time are we going and whatnot? And the air crew are in no hurry. And what's more, they're converting the inside of this kite into a fruiterer's shop. There are not just hands of bananas, but whole sticks of bananas, you know, umpteen hands aren't growing on them. Sacks of pawpaws and loading all kinds of tropical fruit being loaded aboard. So I said to Shorty, the navigator, I said, come on. I said, what time do we get off? And he looked at his watch. He says, oh, hang on. He says, if we go to... He says, we have to get into Whenuapai after 4:20 when the customs men are gone home. He says, because if we take this lot in then, they'll impound the lot of it. He said, because we're not allowed to import tropical fruits without the proper paperwork, decontamination, everything else. He said, so it'll be all right. He says, we get there about 4:25. And that was... The whole flight plan was based on the fact that the air crew who organised all this fruit to take home for their families and so on were determined to get it into Whenuapai after the customs men had packed up for the day. I suppose the customs men were aware of this, but they weren't about to alter their routine for it either. So that's what we did. And so eventually we clamber aboard and start up and trundle off and get into Whenuapai. And there we are immediately whizzed into the reception centre. They find out who we are, where we're from, what unit and everything else, and then shoot us into the medical centre where they check us out to see what tropical ailments we've had whilst we've been away. And I can't remember whether they gave us... although I have the feeling that they didn't, I don't think that we were given Atabrin to take daily for the next 2 or 3 weeks to complete our anti-malarial course. I have the feeling that we didn't. We were certainly issued with 100% wool vests, long sleeve vests and long johns. Now, when you get into New Zealand in January, it's apt to be warmish weather. So the idea of wearing woolen long johns immediately didn't appeal very greatly. But apparently we were supposed to, because as we quickly discovered, going back from a mean annual temperature of 82 to somewhere like New Zealand, where the mean annual temperature is considerably less, you do in fact feel quite cold. When we'd been in the islands, I had always slept below one blanket and a sheet, because the temperature dropped at night to about 70 degrees. And when you get a temperature drop from nearly 100 to 70, it feels chilly. And we'd become used to that. Anyway, all that kit went in my kit bag, and it stayed in the bottom of the kit bag until I took it home and gave it to my father to wear on the farm. He thought it was great stuff. And so we went back to Hamilton, where we got disembarkation leave, and Macaulay and the other chaps were posted away. There was now no oxygen unit required out at Rukahia. The stationary plant was left shut down. And I was moved into the repair depot in Hamilton itself and put into the flight sergeant's office, the engine repair depot side, where, for want of anything better to give me to do, he asked me to reorganise the filing system, which was in a fair old shambles. So I had to set to from scratch and establish a new filing system for him. And one of the first things I did was to go along to the little Chinese laundry opposite the gasworks and collect some laundry which I'd had to leave behind when we went up to Vella Lavella several months ago. I walked in and I can't remember his name, little old Chinese chap and his wife. I walked in and they beamed. Ah, Sergeant Marsden. Laundry off shelf, 1 11 pence or whatever it was, which tickled me to death. And there we were, all set up. I went to see the Percivals again, and Mrs. Percival, I said she'd been a nurse at one time, took one look at me and gave a shocked gasp and hauled me in. I was about a stone underweight and yellow as a guinea from the Atterbrin, and she thought I must have been terribly ill and how dreadful it must be up in the islands and so on. And I suppose it was just temperature and the work and whatnot which had got our weight down. But pretty well everybody who came back from the islands looked rather like the kind of chaps you see in pictures of Japanese prisoners of war, fairly scrawny and yellow and so on. And she proceeded to set about fattening me up, as a result of which, by the time a very few weeks later I was posted back home to England, I was up from some 10.5 stone, which I had been when I got back from the islands, up to damn near 13 stone, and well overweight. I could have stayed in New Zealand, but I was when we got back to the reception depot in Auckland, we were all asked to which station we'd like a posting, because it was the practice on returning from the islands to give the chaps a chance to have a posting near home so they could get home for a spell. And when I was asked, I simply said, well, I'd like to get back to the UK. Oh, wouldn't you like to transfer into the RANSAF, into the New Zealand Air Force? I said, well, I would. I said, but I don't think my wife is too keen to come out here, because I'd sent a cable home before I went into the island. I'd sent a cable home saying, will you come out here? And took long enough to get a reply, and she decided that she wouldn't make the effort. So I thought, well, in that case I might as well get home and see if I can get in onto the second front, which is surely due about now. I think I'd told you that early on, my mother, in 1940, when my mother had asked me how long the war was going to last and how long she should put up rations for, I had then said, you need to store away ration, you know, sugar and things like that, and tinned salmon and all this sort of stuff. I said, you're going to need it for 7 years. I said, because from now until the war's over and we're clear of rationing is going to be about 7 years. Do you remember me?
I don't think you said that. But
Well, this was August 1940. I got home on weekend on a 48-hour pass from, I don't know, it was from West Hampton to Drem. And she said, how long did I think the war would last? And I said, well, I said, everything's going to pot. I said, there's going to be war, there's the North African war's got to be sorted out. I said, it won't be very long now. I said, you'll find out that Hitler, I'm sure, will attack Russia. I said, and that will take a long time to sort out. I said, and of course, the Japanese are going to attack America. She looked at me as though I was balmy. You know, what are you talking about? You must be mad. Why would the Japanese attack America? I said, because they've been talking about it for 20 years. I said, as sure as eggs are eggs, the Japanese are tied up with the Germans and Italy. I said, we're getting this Axis business. I said, they are going to attack America. They're going to take this opportunity when Europe is all tied up, and they're going to attack American bases in the Pacific, and they're going to try to grab the whole of the Pacific for themselves. Oh. I said, now, we've lost our army in France, or all the equipment. I said, that's got to be all rebuilt. I said, here it is in August 1940, and the Air Force, our Air Force here, isn't really worth a packet of salt. We've got all the new four-engine bombers have got to come into service. I said, we've got to build an Air Force that will really do a job. I said, we aren't going to have a smell of getting back into Europe before about 1944. What, one thing or another. I said, that'll take a full year, if we're lucky. I said, the Americans will be in by then, and they'll be over here. I said, it'd take at least a year to clear up Europe. I said, and then the Japanese will need clearing up. I said, so that's going to push you another year on. Of course, I mean, we weren't to know about the atom bomb. I'd heard of such things in science fiction magazines, but I didn't anticipate one. I said, so you can reckon on late 45, 1946, before what we call the war today is going to come to an end. I said, and there's going to be all sorts of bits going on anyway elsewhere. I said, so you reckon on 7 years. And she took me at my word, and 7 years later, she could go to the sideboard and fetch out a tin of John West salmon when I went home. When I was asked then where I'd like to be posted, and I said the UK, and why, I said, well, I'd like to get in on the invasion, get in on this second front business. And I didn't take it seriously, but they did, and they shot me off home. So that in March 44, I found myself on the boat home. Rather sad, in a way, because I loved New Zealand. I'd fallen in love with it. We had, by the way, been given New Zealand citizenship whilst we were out there, so that I voted in in the general elections there. We paid into the New Zealand Social Security scheme, so I suppose if I were to go back even now, I might have some standing. I don't know. Anyway, the ship we were put aboard was Mormac Wren, another Liberty ship, but this time I'm not sure whether it was a US Navy or being operated by a civilian shipping line. I gather that the Mormac Wren, there may have been a Mormac line, I'm not sure, but there were a whole load of boats, Mormac this and Mormac that. There were with us three or four New Zealanders who were being posted to the UK, aircrew buds, and there was a Flight Sergeant Tweedy who'd been in New Zealand since about 1940. He'd been posted from the RAF, and there was a Flight Lieutenant whose name I can't remember, but who, in fact, was the corporal in the hut at Locking when we were posted to Locking from Scampton in 1939, the same character who'd made us blanco and polish our brasses in the middle of the night when we got there. And when I reminded him of this, he fell about laughing. He considered it to have been a great joke, which I suppose it was if he was sitting lying in bed where he was at the time. Anyway, 3 weeks to San Francisco. We were allocated as Ehrlichan gun crews for the trip back, as extra help alongside the normal gunners, and I was ashamed to find out that I was supposed to be able to cock these twin Oerlikons using a steel cable bridle from the cocking handle on the gun over a pulley arrangement down to a peg on the stanchion pillar or whatever on which the gun was mounted. And there was no way I could do it. The youngster who was the gunner was about a stone and a half lighter than me and smaller than me, and he just slipped this bridle into place, got hold of the breast fittings on the gun where you put your body up to the gun in order to fire it, and he just got hold of them and jumped in the air and sprang, and the barrel of the gun went up and the breech end came down, and lo and behold, it was cocked. I damn near gave myself a hernia trying to do the same thing. I couldn't. There was some knack to it which I couldn't grasp. For all I'd got the extra weight. Anyway, in the end, we decided that I wouldn't bother. I wouldn't do it. He'd do it. That's just in case we ever needed to fire the guns. I think on the way back we fired them only once, and that was at a floating target or a balloon or something of that order, just to show willing. But the 3 weeks across the Pacific was nothing more than empty sea and the occasional whale and the cruising albatross and the odd flying fish, the usual sort of thing you saw in those days. And so into San Francisco, where I think we were billeted on a naval station on the edge of the town. I think it was called Angel Island, and where I saw my first Japanese. There was a small Japanese prisoner of war camp there. And it was exactly like the brig on Vela Lavella. The Americans in those days, and probably since, seemed to me to be curiously primitive in their attitude towards men under punishment and prisoners of war. The brig on Vela was simply a palisade of natural poles cut out of the bush, and with a gate, and into it men under punishment were put, and there they were fed, with no toilet facilities, no washing facilities, no hut to sleep in. They were just chucked in there, and if they had 28 days in the brig, then they spent 28 days in there, living on the bare earth, with nothing at all except their daily food. Quite disgusting conditions, and the Japanese prisoners of war, I suppose, were getting the bare Hague convention set up, but it didn't look very good. It was a wired enclosure with bare earth, and I suppose there was a hut in which they slept at the end, and there were 15 Japanese prisoners, whom I gathered were the total prisoners of war taken in the Pacific up to that date.
How many?
15. Perhaps one of the reasons why there were so few was related to the business on Guadalcanal, where I was told on good authority that in one Marine battalion, a youngster who was found to be only 15 or 16, was kept out of the line by the goodwill of the officers concerned and given the job of marching Japanese prisoners of war back to the base until they caught on to the fact that he was marching them off and returning with extraordinary swiftness. And what he was doing, he was marching them away until he was well out of hearing or anything else of the people in the line at the front there, and simply putting the Tommy gun onto them and ploughing the lot up, pushing them into the underbrush, and then going back for some more. At which point they decided that they'd take him off that particular duty and make sure he was kept right back at the base. I don't know what happened to that youngster.
Who told you that?
A Marine sergeant.
That was on Vela Lavella?
On Guadalcanal. That would be in the fighting during late 42. That was before we got up there.
you say why he had that attitude towards the prisoners?
Oh, it was fairly endemic amongst the Americans anyway. There was... you know that there... I hope no American listening too carefully to this, but there is a tendency for Americans to overreact to insult and injury to hands on heart, our United States. And the reaction to Pearl Harbor at this time was still enormously strong. The effect of the fighting in the Pacific and the shipping losses, the US naval losses that they'd had at Midway and other places and so on, hit very hard. You have to remember that a lot of these chaps had been closely involved. One of the buds I was given to become part of the of my crew on Vela La Vela had been aboard the USS Chicago when she was clobbered. She was torpedoed two or three times. They spent two or three days with the decks within a foot of the water. They were practically awash. He, for instance, Red Skel- his name was Skelton. He was about 6 foot three, from Indiana, a real country boy, fairly thick in all directions and mentally, red-haired, hence Red Skelton. Sheer chance that there was a film star of the same name. He would not go below decks in the USS Arrowhead. He slept on deck. There was no way you could get him to go below deck. He was terrified of being torpedoed again. And the hammering that Chicago had had certainly marked him. And there was a lot of that kind of thing about. There was a literal hatred of the Japanese, and which had not been eased at all by the news that filtered back from the fighting, you know, Singapore and all the other places, and the Philippines and Java and the East Indies, where Australians had been crucified and beheaded and so on. You have to remember that in 1943, it's close enough for this to be a very emotional reaction to the whole business of the Japanese onslaught. And that wherever you went in the islands, there were people who'd been there, who'd been in it, who'd seen it, and who talked about it. So the Americans were quite sanguine about not taking many prisoners. The Marines, in fact, were in no hurry to take prisoners anyway. You know, people casually talk about today about sporting events, and he's not taking any prisoners. They really don't know what it means. And it was the Pacific War was a very nasty war indeed. I can remember during my time in New Zealand and so on, seeing those Damien Para films of the Kokoda Trail in New Guinea, and I can do it now. You could cry your eyes out watching those poor bastards clambering up that Kokoda Trail. I know it's newsreel and we weren't anywhere near it, but once you've been in the islands, you know what it's like. I think that was one of the most dreadful campaigns of the war. And I'd probably feel better about it if I'd been in it, rather than only seeing those poor beggars struggling.
So,
anyway,
what precipitated these reminiscences was the Japanese POW camp on Angel.
Oh yes, and that just triggered the whole shooting match off, and that of course triggers off another thing which I've forgotten, which I had forgotten to bring up on the trip back across the Pacific. In Mulmac Wren, we discovered that the main cargo, we were in, I think we were in the rear hold, in number four hold. In the forward hold, these cargo ships were rigged so that the holds could be rigged for the return, I suppose, when they were loaded as well, but I hadn't really noticed it. Instead of having just a hole from the ship's bottom clear up to the deck, they were rigged with timbers so that at each deck up, I don't know how many decks there were in a seaboat, one or two or whatever, but anyway, the timbers were laid across the hold space to make a floor, and we were in fact I suppose on the first deck down, and that was where our accommodation was, over this temporary floor with bunks set up. And in the forward hold there were padded cells. These were knocked down cells, rather like the officers' cabins in the old wooden wall sailing ships, so that they were knocked down and into flats and stored when the ship came from America to New Zealand loaded with war stores, and then when the ship was empty to go back, they were erected in this forward hold as padded cells, and men who had cracked or for various reasons were, you can describe it any way you like, Troppo, Doolally, whatever, they were taken back to America for hospital treatment in these padded cells. And at every mealtime, the cells, of which the doors were normally closed with not much more than the peephole into them for the orderlies to look into, these doors were opened onto a barred door, like an American cell door, behind the solid door. Meals were twice a day, thank God. That was enough. And when they were opened, you've never heard such a cacophony of sound as came up out of that hold. It was a cross between the sort of insane laughter you hear from a skein of geese when they go over on a cold autumn night or a winter night, when you've heard geese cackling, laughing. Sounds eerie, doesn't it?
Yes.
So you take that. Now you take the sounds of a fox hunting pack cubbing in the New Forest on a September morning or August morning or whenever they do it. There's another eerie set of sounds of the hounds baying and yelping and the riders hallooing and so on. And you mix that up with yells of total desperation and despair and sounds like I find it quite difficult to describe accurately. Most god-awful sound you ever heard. And there's these, I suppose there must have been 20 of them, all being carted back, wreckage from the wall. Some of them would have become what they were from drinking home brew, jungle juice. Again, call it what you like. They drank torpedo fluid, they drank compass fluid, they made jungle juice from canned orange juice and whatever, fermenting it up, or from fermented pawpaws and Lord knows what. They even had packets of raisins and sultanas sent out from home to make it so they could brew it up. In fact, when the news got out that we built a still on Vella La Vella for distilling, we were distilling our own distilled water